hospitals, apartment buildings, universities, research facilities, and bridges. How is Iran dealing with its own reconstruction and economic crisis?
It's very difficult. I mean, I think we don't fully understand the extent of the damage and destruction that has been wrought inside of Iran. And, you know, the Iranians, of course, do have a difficult time in importing goods. But I will note something quite significant. After Abbas Araghchi left Pakistan last weekend, when Trump claimed that they were going to be meeting with the Americans and then it didn't happen, just as the Iranians said it wouldn't, Pakistan announced that it was going to effective immediately implement a directive that would facilitate a dramatic expansion of transit across Pakistan for third country goods delivering to Iran. What that is part of is the bilateral relationship between Iran and Pakistan, and it's a direct answer to Trump saying that he's strangling Iran. So this meeting with the Russians, this trade deal that now has been put into force with the Pakistanis to give free passage to third nation goods coming into Iran, the deepening relationship between Iran and China, which has largely unfolded in secret away from cameras, and then Iran's now outreach in the Persian Gulf, is very clearly Iran imagining a world where this doesn't get resolved right away, and that Iran certainly survives intact with its state, its government, its power structure very much in control of Iran. And they're looking for an alternative to a full solution or resolution with the United States. That's going to be a key thing to watch. Iran is not just operating on some desperate track to try to make a deal with the United States. You know, this is a real nation state. This isn't just some, you know, paper tiger that the U.S. can assassinate some people and do heavy bombing and then they collapse. This is a country of institutions. Whatever anyone thinks about Iran, they've spent 47 years building institutions that have parallel infrastructure. I don't think there is a historical precedent for having basically the entire upper echelons of political, military, and religious leadership assassinated and then turn around and do 6 to 7 weeks of retaliatory strikes that fought the world superpower to a standstill. There isn't a historical precedent for what we're seeing. And I think now the United States and Trump's advisors understand they have to take this seriously. And Iran is operating on a totally different path that presumes that they aren't going to have a political resolution to this crisis or conflict with the United States.
Jeremy Scahill, co-founder of DropSite News, thanks so much for joining us. We'll link to your new piece, as Trump's narrative on negotiations flails. Iran is setting its own terms for ending the war, at democracynow.org. On Friday, I'll be joined by the other co-founder of DropSite News, Ryan Grimm. That's May 1st at 6:45 for a screening of the new film about Democracy Now!, Steal This Story, Please, at AFI Silver in Silver Spring. The film also features Jeremy Scahill. It's a fundraiser for WHUT, Howard University PBS. For more information, go to democracynow.org. Coming up, the United Arab Emirates has pulled out of OPEC in a move to increase its oil production. We'll look at what the Iran war means for the push to transition away from fossil fuels. Stay with us.
Monsanto, ruler of the earth, air and water too. Have you ever figured what you're gonna do? Start over again. Monsanto, ruler of the earth, air and water too. Have you ever figured what you're gonna do when you find you've poisoned even you?
Bad Monsanto by the late folk musician Michael Hurley in our Democracy Now! Studio in 2020. He died a year ago this month. We'll be talking about Monsanto's Roundup pesticide later in the broadcast. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On the road to Rochester, New York, where I'll be speaking at Monroe Community College today at noon. We turn now to the long-term impact of the Iran war and the near closure of the Strait of Hormuz on energy systems nationwide, worldwide. On Tuesday, the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, announced it's leaving OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, by the end of the week. The UAE has long disagreed with Saudi Arabia over oil production quotas and says it's leaving the group to focus on national interests and increase its production capacity. The announcement came just as leaders of the six Gulf countries gathered in Saudi Arabia to discuss the regional crisis created by the war and the impact of Iran attacking their energy infrastructure. As countries across the globe brace for the ripple effects of the energy shocks created by the war, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen addressed the European Parliament earlier today. She warned the consequences of the current energy crisis could last for years.
So the way forward is obvious. We must reduce our overdependency on imported fossil fuels, and we must boost our homegrown, affordable, clean energy supply from renewables to nuclear in full respect of technology neutrality.
For more on the energy crisis and what the wars meant for the push to a clean energy transition, we're joined now in London by Bloomberg CEDAR senior climate reporter Akshad Rathi. He is the host of the Zero podcast and newsletter on climate solutions, author of Climate Capitalism, Winning the Global Race to Zero Emissions. Thanks so much for joining us. Start off by talking about the significance, Akshad, of UAE pulling out of OPEC.
So UAE is the third largest producer of oil in that cartel, and it is a cartel. It increases production and decreases production to try and control the price, keep it high enough so that oil exporting countries can balance their budgets and subsidize a lot of the lifestyle that is there in these oil-rich economies. The fact that the UAE has pulled out means that this cartel will have less ability to be able to push up the price when it wants. And we've already seen some of it not working because there are all these other producers like the USA, but also places like Guyana that are increasing their production a lot. And that means the power that OPEC had been weakening already. And this will be a big blow to them purely if they are looking at just price control.
If you can talk about what all of this means for a transition away from fossil fuels. I mean, we're speaking as that meeting in Santa Marta, Colombia, is taking place. Where is this all headed?
So we are currently living through what the International Energy Agency calls the biggest energy shock that the world has experienced. This is bigger than the 1970s dual oil shocks that were there in 73 and 79 in sheer volumes, but also as a share of total energy consumption, because it's not just oil, but also liquefied natural gas that is getting blocked in the Strait of Hormuz. And in the past, when countries were faced with this kind of energy shock, they had options that were quite limited. In the short term, they could try and pay more money if they had more money, or they could try and reduce the use in some form by telling people to do less of something. But this time around, beyond those two options, there is a third or a fourth option that countries have, which is to try and deploy as much renewables so that they can build energy supply at home, because most countries have plenty of sun and the wind, and to deploy electric vehicles or electric infrastructure that would consume energy in the form of electricity, which is just a much more efficient way of consuming energy. So for every unit of electricity, if you can go a mile in an electric car, you can only go a third of the mile in a gasoline car. And so that is what most countries are looking towards. And this meeting in Santa Marta, that is the first meeting of countries, and it's not all countries in the world, is the countries that want to transition away from fossil fuels, a few dozen, 50, 60 countries. They are meeting at this moment because they have found that the international framework for governance on climate, which is under the United Nations, isn't addressing this key challenge, which is countries that are A, dependent on fossil fuel imports, want to move away from fossil fuels. And then there are countries that are progressive and realize, yes, we are fossil fuel producers today, but we cannot be fossil fuel producers for long. And so we need to figure out how can we wean our economies off fossil fuel revenue and move towards a cleaner future, even if the world doesn't care about climate change.
We just heard the European Commission president say that we have to reduce our dependency on imported fossil fuels. You're always, as a climate reporter, looking at success stories from Ethiopia to the Philippines. As we begin to wrap up, talk about the significance of what's happening now and if that is accelerating as a result, maybe an unintended consequence of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran.
Well, we should note that when the 1970s oil crisis happened, and this was importing countries in North America and Europe, they turned to making themselves more efficient, trying to find cleaner sources like nuclear in their mix. But they were rich countries, and they could at that time invest in these technologies in a big way. This time around, if that was the path that the world had to take, developing countries would have really struggled. But what is now happening, as you point out, in places like Ethiopia, you know, $1,000 per capita income, one of the poorest countries, or the Philippines, this, you know, islanded nation with like really difficult terrains to work through. They are turning to clean energy sources because they are affordable and they are cheap. And sure, much of that comes from China, but most of the developing countries that are importing fossil fuels are importing economies anyway. So rather than import fuel and fuel burning devices, they're like, well, we'll just import electric vehicles and make the fuel on ourselves by importing some of the renewables. And so this is the kind of move that we've not seen in the past. And most of the acceleration on the energy transition is likely to happen in developing countries that are really dependent on fossil fuel imports today.
On Monday, you tweeted climate change headlines from around the world, writing, "We might be in the middle of wars, but the climate crisis takes no break." I mean, you've got the U.S. state of Georgia declaring a state of emergency after wildfires burned over 39,000 acres and destroyed more than 120 homes in the Great Plains. Intense drought is threatening winter wheat harvest. And of course, as you talked about in India, extreme heat right now.
Well, the climate crisis does not take a break. It is a crisis that is caused by us putting out all these carbon emissions into the atmosphere. But then its impacts are run by the rules of physics and chemistry. So even if our societies currently aren't interested, aren't willing to act on the climate crisis, that crisis continues to get worse. You know, as a climate reporter going into summer, it's always an anxious time. People are thinking about holidays, but I'm thinking about extreme weather events that are going to go up a notch because the planet continues to get hotter. We are also looking at an El Nino formation, perhaps a super El Nino formation, which is this natural cycle that adds even more heat to the Northern Hemisphere during this period, which means extreme weather events that are being made worse by climate change could get even more extreme because a natural phenomenon adds on top. So I think, you know, as much as many countries, including the United States, can ignore this crisis for now, most countries do not have that comfort, and which is why the meeting at Santa Marta is so important, because the countries that are most vulnerable, island nations, they are there in Santa Marta trying to push for a legal framework to try and figure out how the world can transition away from fossil fuels. And it seems like a marginal conversation now, but it will show up again and again, because this meeting is also going to happen another year in Tuvalu, they've confirmed. So next year's meeting will look to try and get this instrument going, if it can.
Akshat Rathi, senior reporter for climate at Bloomberg and the host of the Zero podcast, author of Climate Capitalism, Winning the Global Race to Zero Emissions. Tune in on Thursday when we'll speak with journalist Bill McKibben about his new piece, The Iran War is Another Reason to Quit Oil. Coming up, we are bombarding America's forests with Roundup, a new investigation by Mother Jones after this.
Of your every crime, the GMO potato, that McDonald's buys, and now it ain't even safe to eat a mess of fries. Monsanto, GMO canola, corn oil in all the soy.
Bad Monsanto by the late folk musician Michael Hurley from our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Justices at the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments on Monday in a case that could determine whether thousands of cancer patients can keep suing the manufacturers of the popular weed killer glyphosate, or Roundup. The pesticide was developed by Monsanto, which was bought by Bayer in 2018. Critics of Roundup have long alleged a link between the herbicide and cancer. On Monday, justices appeared to be split on whether a federal law that regulates the sale and marketing of herbicides preempts state-level lawsuits against manufacturers. The case centers on whether the federal government or states should decide what warning labels should be put on herbicides. The main plaintiff in the case is a Missouri man named John Durnell. He's alleged two decades of exposure to the chemical caused him to develop blood cancer. A jury found Bayer had failed to warn him of the risks associated with Roundup and awarded him $1.25 million in damages. The Trump administration, which has called Roundup safe, is siding with Bayer. Meanwhile, Mother Jones and the Center for Investigative Reporting have just released a major investigation looking at how the U.S. Forest Service has been rapidly expanding its use of the herbicide despite concerns about Roundup safety. In a moment, we'll be joined by investigative reporter Nate Halverson. But first, let's turn to excerpts of a short documentary he made as part of the investigation he did with data reporter Melissa Lewis.
We found that over the past 20 years, the use of glyphosate has more than quadrupled in California forests.
Check out this map that Melissa made. We only have these numbers on California because the state is crazy enough to make everyone report their pesticide use. And thank God they do, because no other state apparently does it. And so we have almost no clue what it looks like elsewhere. Almost no clue. I dug up this crazy long appendix to another crazy long EPA report, and guess what? It gives me an estimate for national use. And you know where it estimated that 90% of forest spraying was happening? In southern states. So California is only a drop in the bucket. These southern states are some of the biggest timber producers in the country. And companies are using it right after they log the land, spraying glyphosate everywhere to make way for the next generation of trees. The timber companies and the Forest Service are using Roundup in the woods to help trees grow back faster. And then one day, they can cut them all down again, make more money, and repeat the process. They are treating millions of acres of forest just like a row of corn.
An excerpt from a new short documentary by journalist Nate Halverson from Mother Jones, who'll join us in a minute. But first, another excerpt from the documentary.
For decades, Monsanto, the original maker of Roundup, has insisted the product is safe when used as directed. But in 2015, the World Health Organization released a landmark assessment saying glyphosate is probably carcinogenic. It sparked all those lawsuits.
The most popular weed killer in the world may cause cancer. That is the determination by the International Agency for Research on Cancer.
The optics were really bad, and PR catastrophes like this didn't help.
You can drink a whole quart of it and it won't hurt you.
You want to drink some? We have some here.
I'd be happy to, actually. But yeah. Not really, but...
Not really?
I know it wouldn't hurt me.
If you say so, I have some glyphosate.
No, I'm not stupid.
Ah, okay, so you...
No, but I know...
So it's dangerous,
I know,
right?
No, people try to commit suicide regularly.
Tell the truth.
It's not dangerous to humans. No, it's not.
So you're ready to drink one glass of glyphosate?
No, I'm not an idiot.
Here's where the safety debate and our investigation takes a turn, because Monsanto's strategy went way beyond public relations. Monsanto was secretly behind some of the most influential scientific reports. It was padding the scientific studies in its favor.
An excerpt from the short documentary by investigative journalist Nate Halverson, an Emmy award-winning producer for Reveal. The video accompanies this new article from Mother Jones headlined, "We're Bombarding America's Forests with Roundup." Nate Halverson joins us from San Francisco. Hi, Nate. If you can start off by talking about the oral arguments the Supreme Court heard this week around Roundup, and then how that relates to this major investigation you've done for Mother Jones Reveal.
Yeah, so the Supreme Court, as you said, was hearing whether or not people will be able to sue in state courts. And because essentially on the federal level, the EPA had previously come out and said that Roundup and glyphosate, the chemical behind Roundup, was safe. I think it's worth noting that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals actually overturned the EPA's decision, noting that the EPA had failed in coming to this conclusion that it does not cause cancer, that by its own research, the majority of studies it looked at indicated it had caused non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So even on the federal level, there's a lot of uncertainty around the safety. And in the state courts, I mean, some of the information you saw there in the documentary, we only have like the internal emails from Monsanto employees talking about creating these fabricated, or as they say, ghost-written studies. We only have that information now because people were able to sue in state courts. And in that very first lawsuit that came forward, which was here in the Bay Area, the jury determined that Monsanto had acted with, quote, malice. And part of that was because of their dummying up of the science, which a state appellate court upheld and said was very reasonable for the jury to have concluded.
So if you can talk about Trump issuing an executive order deeming glyphosate critical to national security. He even invoked the Defense Production Act to bolster its domestic production.
Yeah, the Trump administration has, both in the first term, when some of these internal emails that came out in the lawsuit quoted a lobbyist saying the Trump administration was telling Monsanto that they had nothing to worry about from them, that they had Monsanto's back around products like glyphosate, to now, of course, the executive order, which provides legal protection and also is an attempt to boost domestic production, to their intervention in the Supreme Court case. It's a long list of the ways that the Trump administration has stepped forward to help glyphosate. Of course, the majority of glyphosate is still used in agriculture, but it is, we found by building this database of 5 million records with pesticide reports here in California, we were able to show that the fastest growing use is actually now for forestry. And previous to Trump basically giving the shield laws to the manufacturers of glyphosate, you know, Bayer, he had issued a executive order to increase timber production across national forests by 25%. And so when you combine these two things, what you're talking about is a rapid potential increase. Well, we've seen it historically, but even going forward, a continued rapid increased use of Roundup and glyphosate in the forests of the United States.
I want to go back to another clip of your short documentary released as part of your new investigation on bombarding America's forests with Roundup.
So I wanted to talk to the Forest Service officials behind spraying glyphosate.
We're looking for Ranger Nickerson.
So I went to their outpost near my cabin in the little town of Chester, California, and I sat down with District Ranger Russell Nickerson, who oversees like 500,000 acres of Lhasa National Forest. It was his decision to spray glyphosate here.
So I'm the decision maker for the district, so for that land base.
Is it safe to use?
I mean, really, if you want to talk more herbicide details, it's probably our Washington office that you would talk to on that.
You know, there's now been more than $10 billion in settlements and jury verdicts, you know, to people who got sick after being exposed to glyphosate. Does that raise concerns?
Yeah, I mean, it does from that level.
I asked him about U.S. Surgeon General nominee Dr. Casey Means.
You know, she said, glyphosate, which is the most commonly used pesticide in the United States, has a direct relationship with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Sorry, I gotta stop you right now. Is that something that, I mean, he can discuss things that are in the purview of the project?
Yeah.
And right now, it's getting outside of, like not in his official capacity. So if we can stick with the project and not so much what's the tools that are being, that are potentially being used.
Yeah.
So, Nate Halverson, if you can talk about that scene and the interruption, and then also talk about the Trump administration's interest in siding with Bayer, which has gone against the so-called MAHA agenda, Make America Healthy Again. MAHA wants crop chemicals reduced, if not banned entirely. What's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, this was a fascinating moment, right? But this is the person we were interviewing there is in charge of the spraying. You know, he runs half a million acres of national forest land. And so I just asked him point blank, is it safe to use? And he can't say yes, it's safe to use. And, you know, I pulled all of the inspection reports that the state has accrued. You know, they're spraying hundreds of thousands of acres. So I pulled all of the reports for inspection. Only 11 times in the state of California had they actually gone out to see if they were appropriately spraying this. I mean, if the workers themselves were wearing the necessary protective equipment. And I found that of those 11, I found photos of contractors, and foresters tell me these are predominantly Latino workers, Hispanic workers coming up from Mexico and Central America, that you see them coming out of the forest covered in Roundup. And this is the same when you have this skin contact. This is the same situation that resulted in all of these successful lawsuits against Monsanto, against Bayer, and these guys who are moving around, oftentimes contracted workers that don't speak English, are covered in it. And so I also asked him about that, and he couldn't say that that was safe. And so I think we have a real concern here, both for the communities around where this is being sprayed, but also for the people that are doing the spraying. And I think it's also important to note that the EPA itself says that this adversely or harms 93% of endangered species. And we're spraying it across these incredibly environmentally sensitive areas. And of the 7% it doesn't hurt, it's like whales. It's things that aren't even in the forest. So I think MAHA movement has long, you know, since the MAHA movement formed, which was really formed out of other groups that had long advocated for some of these environmental issues, they really don't, they don't like Roundup. President Trump has come out in favor of Roundup. And so I think you're beginning to see a real schism between President Trump's base.
Nate Halverson, Emmy Award-winning producer at Reveal and the Center for Investigative Reporting, will link to your new piece, We're Bombarding America's Forests with Roundup. That does it for our show. Today, I'm headed to Rochester for a speech at Monroe Community College at noon. I hope folks come out. And then on Friday, May 1st, I'll be doing a fundraiser with the screening of Steal the Story, Please! At AFI Silver in Silver Spring for WHUT-PBS. You can go to our website for more information, as well as a fundraiser for WPFW on May 2nd at noon at the same theater. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, this is Tim from Stereolab, and you're listening to Noise of Carpet on CJSF 90.1. and cjsf.ca.
Awesome. Thanks, Tim. You know why you listen to this station. It plays new music, supports your community, and provides up-to-date news that you know you can trust. And unlike other stations, the people who work and volunteer here are a part of your community. Remember, though, they do this on a shoestring budget. The solution is the Community Radio Initiative. You can find out more details at mycri.ca. In just a few clicks, you can generate an email to send to the politicians who need to hear your message. mycri.ca.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait at Radio Rewind. Now we wait at Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM.